Well, today we're continuing along our journey through the minor prophets. And we've gotten through nine of them so far, and we have just then three remaining. The book we're going to tackle this afternoon is Haggai. And Haggai is one of those short minor prophets that we don't really refer to real often, don't turn to a lot of scriptures in that little book. But it's a very interesting one, and it actually has a great deal of relevance to us, and we'll emphasize that as we move through the book of Haggai. The last three of the minor prophets that will be looked at as they're arranged in Scripture are called the post-exilic prophets. Exilic, E-X-I-L-I-C. Meaning post-exile or after the time that they were in slavery in Babylon. Earlier prophets had warned Israel and Judah, beginning in as early as about 760 B.C. up to 605. Remember last month we reviewed the book of Habakkuk, which was the last of the prophets who came to Judah just before their punishment, their exile, their slavery began. Other prophets that we've already looked at that warned Israel and Judah before their captivity were included Hosea, Micah, Amos, Zephaniah, and Habakkuk. Of course, Isaiah wrote before both Israel and Judah went into captivity, or at least he started his work before they did, as did Jeremiah. We also remember that the 10 tribes of Israel, after their captivity, and which was finalized in the year 718 B.C., after their nation was conquered, those 10 tribes were scattered among the nations. And they did not, for over 2,500 years, have then received the blessings that God had for the descendants of Abraham. Judah was a different case. Judah and the temple were destroyed. The nation was taken into captivity starting in about 605 to 586 B.C. The temple was destroyed at the end of that time frame in 586 or about 585, somewhere in that time range. Judah did not lose its identity. Judah came out of its captivity and it did maintain its identity as a nation or as a tribe of Israel. People are somewhat confused. They often think that Judah is Israel. But Judah, as we understand, is one tribe or one part of Israel. But they did maintain their identity. When they returned from Babylon, they were instructed to rebuild the temple. That was their primary first responsibility. Of course, the people were interested in rebuilding their lives, rebuilding the city, reclaiming their place. But God had specifically told them to build his temple when they returned. We'll see in a minute that that was the commission that they were given to do. Haggai came to Judah in the year 520. Judah by this time had been released from their captivity in 538. So it was nearly 20 years since they had returned from their captivity. But at this point, the temple had still not been rebuilt. Haggai's primary message to the people of Judah was that they needed to get back to the job that they were sent to do, which was to build the temple. The name Haggai means festive or festive one or my feast. It has to do with the festivals. The Hebrew word hag, H-A-G, is the word for festival, and it literally means to move or dance in a circle. So it has to do with celebration and a festive occasion, which is how God designed his festivals to be, a time of celebration for his people. And we certainly do celebrate as we observe those days. It reminds us of another stage of God's plan, and it's a time for celebration. The name Haggai is probably shortened from another version of the word Haggaiah, which means a feast of Yahweh. So it has to do, again, with being festive and celebrating at a time that God had set aside for that purpose. The commentaries mention that Haggai was actually a very popular name back in that time frame. Wouldn't know it today. It's not a name that is common, but it was a popular name among the Jews back in the 500s BC. All we know of the man Haggai is what we find here in this book and a couple of references to him in the book of Ezra, which we'll look at in a couple of minutes. There's some speculation that Haggai might have been an older man, because in chapter 2, verse 3, that says, "Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory, and how do you see it now?" The thought is that may imply that Haggai himself was one who could think back on and remember the first temple, the temple that was destroyed some 70 years earlier. If that had been the case, then he would have been at least old enough to remember having seen it, so he would have been quite elderly at the time that he wrote this book, if that was the case. It's speculation. There's nothing that really tells us that was the case. But it's part of the, some have theorized that since he was so elderly, that may be why his work was so short. We'll see when we go through the book that his message was given over a period of about 4 months. And that's the whole length of time of his message. But we'll see that he had quite an impact. The temple and the rebuilding of the temple is the important theme in the book. The word for temple that is used throughout Haggai means house, literally means a house, or as we see it in this context, a dwelling place for God. God's dwelling place is something that he has always emphasized in terms of the connection that it has to his people. From the very beginning of the time after God led Israel out of Egypt, God chose to dwell with his people. Let's look quickly at Exodus chapter 25. Remember that the covenant was made beginning in chapter 20. So this is just 7-8 weeks or so after they had come out of Egypt. We'll find this statement is made here in Exodus 25. That he told the people in the first few verses to take up an offering of various items and that they were to be used for a special purpose. Verse 8, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." God dwells among his people. He always has. It's always been his desire. If you continue on to chapter 40, verse 17. Let's just take a look at that. Exodus 40, verse 17. Says that it came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. So this tells us that just before the Passover, which would have been the first Passover they observed after leaving Egypt, almost exactly a year after they had left Egypt, the tabernacle itself was completed. The work was done on it. So the tabernacle then was completed and began to be used by Israel in the year 1442 BC. And this became the center. It was where the altar was. It's where the sacrifices were made. And it continued to be the place of God's dwelling with his people for 486 years. It was in the year 957 that Solomon completed the building of the first temple. Now, during that 486, almost 500 years, there were a lot of ups and downs in the history of Israel. And there were times when the people didn't worship at and use the tabernacle in the way that it was intended. But that was the representation of God dwelling with his people for a long period of time. In fact, the tabernacle itself was the place that represented God's dwelling with his people longer than either of the other two temples that were built. They stood for a shorter period of time than the tabernacle itself. Again, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, we'll see that when Judah was released from captivity, they were specifically told to build a dwelling for God. It was very important to him. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22, says, "In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah came, that the word of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation." Now, by this time, Babylon had been replaced. Remember the sequence of kingdoms that is given in Daniel 2? There was, first of all, Babylon, and the second kingdom was Persia. So by the time the end of the captivity had come, of Judah's captivity, Persia was now the dominant empire. They had replaced Babylon. "The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout his kingdom and put it in writing, saying, 'Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the eternal God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May the Lord God be with him. Let him go up to build.'" So the king of Persia released the people of Judah to return to Jerusalem, and it was God had, in effect, told through him, given his command that the people would rebuild his temple. Just across the page in Ezra chapter 1, verse 2, says, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the eternal God has given to me." Kind of repeats his proclamation. "He's commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem. And who is among you of all his people? May his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the eternal God of Israel." And that proclamation continues then into the next verse. God's dwelling place among his people is not incidental. It is very important to him. It was very important to God that the people should honor him by focusing on him and worshiping him in this way. So we've seen that the tabernacle was built. We saw that in Exodus chapter 40. In 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 3, you'll read of the completion of the first temple, the temple that Solomon built, and God placed his blessing upon it. 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 3. It mentions in the first two verses here in this chapter that Solomon had completed the building. Verse 3, "And the eternal God said to him," to Solomon, "I've heard your prayer and your supplication, and you have that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually." Again, it emphasizes, and the principle we want to show here and to emphasize is that temple was very important to God. When it was destroyed, it was desecrated. God's name was, in effect, tarnished as his people were punished. And when they returned, he wanted them to rebuild the house, the temple, for him. That temple, which they built, was again destroyed in the year 70 A.D. The house that was completed during the time of Haggai, Ezra, that temple was destroyed. Today, we understand that the church of God is his household. This is an important parallel that we'll emphasize as we go through the rest of the book, or the book of Haggai. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. Ephesians, the second chapter, verse 19. Paul, of course, is writing to a mixed congregation of Gentiles and Jews in the city of Ephesus, in the region of Asia where he served. And he writes then a kind of a concluding statement here at the end of this passage. He says in verse 19 of Ephesians 2, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." We can take this in a couple of ways. First of all, specifically writing to the Gentiles, that they now had been incorporated into God's household along with the Jewish members of the church. The Gentiles who were called into the church were every bit as much of a part of that household as the Jews were. We can also see this in our own calling and conversion, that we also, who at one time were apart from, outside of the household of God, are now included in that household by our calling, by baptism. We become part of that household. Verse 20, he continues, "Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus and Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." The temple of God is just as important to him now as it was in the time when Haggai was writing to the Jews. Now, the church of God is that temple. The development of the members of God's church through spiritual growth and spiritual development and conversion, as is what it is speaking of, as we're being fitted or knit together as that spiritual temple. So the temple of God is every bit as important to him now as it was in Haggai's time. And the urgency of building that temple is the parallel that we see as we look at the book of Haggai. That God is urgent, that God is serious, that it's important to God that his temple in this age also be built and be established. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and I think, again, this is not something we're not familiar with, but we want to see it in the context here of the book of Haggai. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19. Ephesians 2 speaks of the church as a whole, that as a collection of members, we form the temple. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19 makes it more personal. Paul writes, "Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, which is in you, which you have from God, and that you are not your own?" Individually, as well as collectively, God views us as his temple. We saw in Ephesians 2 that the church, in a general sense, is where God's Spirit dwells. Here in 1 Corinthians 6, we see that it dwells in us individually and personally. So we're going to see a very personal application to the book of Haggai as we go through it, that we are that temple, as a group and individually. and that we have a responsibility, and God takes it very seriously, and we must also to build that temple. Now, the church has more than one function. I want to just touch on this. We're talking primarily about our personal development and conversion process, which this the temple implies. But we also have another responsibility as a body. Matthew 28, verse 18. Mr. Franks has emphasized this about how that we have two legs to stand on, so to speak. We have two areas that are of equal importance as the church, those that are called into the body of the church at this point. Matthew 28, verse 18, Jesus spoke to the disciples, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe things that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." Together, as that collective body, the church has the responsibility to continue to proclaim the message that Jesus Christ introduced. Whatever he taught, we are to teach. He taught two things primarily. First of all, the good news of the kingdom, the gospel. What the kingdom is, what it's about, the good news about the kingdom. And secondly, what a person must do, the way we must live, to become part of that kingdom. So, that was the message of Jesus Christ, and together the church has the responsibility of continuing to proclaim that message. So just as it was critical, it was critically important that the people of Judah not be distracted from working on the building of the temple, the lesson for us is that we must not be distracted from our part in building the spiritual temple. Personal growth and being drawn together to become the kind of people as a group that God is looking for his church to be, and supporting the work of preaching the gospel. Those are of primary importance to us because that's what God expects of us. It's what he expects us to devote our lives to. Haggai delivered his message to Judah in the year 520. And again, we'll see that it took place over a period of about 4 months. The Jews, after having been released to Jerusalem, released from captivity, had returned, but they had not finished the job that God had given them to do. So Haggai's responsibility was to remind them what they should have been busy doing. We looked at 2 Chronicles 36. Let's quickly go back to that area once more, because it does speak of the time when Israel and when Judah came out of their captivity. In verses 15 and 16, they're reminded that God had sent prophets to them to warn them. Those are among them were the prophets that we mentioned earlier, who had given their message to Judah and Israel, but had been ignored. In verses 17 through 21, we see a description of the destruction of the nation of Judah. And then in verses 22 and 23, we saw the proclamation, which is repeated in chapter 1 of Ezra. Let's look ahead in Ezra to chapter 3. We'll just get a couple more verses here in Ezra to set the stage for Haggai's message to them. Ezra chapter 3, verse 1 says, "When the seventh month had come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man in Jerusalem. Then Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as was written in the law of Moses. Though fear had come upon them because of the people of those countries, they set the altar on its bases. They offered burnt offerings on it to the Eternal, the morning and the evening sacrifices, and they kept the Feast of Tabernacles, says in verse 4. So when the people initially returned, they at least established the altar. They restored the altar upon which sacrifices could be offered. However, they did not carry on fully and complete the rebuilding of the temple. Drop down to verse 8. It says that in the second month of the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, so this takes us ahead forward several months, Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the brethren of the saints and the priests, all those who had come out of the captivity, began work and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and above to oversee the work of the house of the Eternal. They laid the foundation, verse 10. They laid the foundation of the temple. Now, this would have been in about the year 537, just after they had returned from Jerusalem. So they laid the foundation of the temple. The priests stood in their apparel and with trumpets and with cymbals, and they celebrated the establishing of the foundation of the temple. They sang songs, verse 11. They praised God. The people shouted a great shout when they praised the Eternal. Verse 12, but many of the priests and Levites and heads of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. But others, yet many, shouted for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off. In other words, there were mixed feelings when work started on this second temple. Those who had seen the first temple saw that this temple was not going to be anything at all as beautiful, as impressive as the temple had been that Solomon built. But others, perhaps out of a sense of repentance and out of a sense of excitement that at least the temple was being rebuilt, were shouting for joy at the prospect of what was about to be done. So it was not at the time that, well, it was a time of mixed feelings, put it that way. Chapter 4, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord, they came to Zerubbabel and the fathers' houses, and they said to them that they wanted to help build. But the people of Judah refused to let others who lived in the land be part of their project of rebuilding the temple. Verse 4, then the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah, and they troubled them in building. They hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of King Cyrus, even until the reign of Darius. So this shows us what happened. This was what led to the time when Haggai came on the scene. They had returned. They'd rebuilt and established the altar. They had laid the foundations of the temple. But then, because of difficulties, problems, hassles from the people around them, they did not continue with the effort to rebuild the temple. They let it stall out. Verse 24, thus the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, ceased, and it discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius. Then, chapter 5, verse 1, the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews. in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So this is the setting then as Haggai comes upon the scene, that the people had not continued in their efforts to rebuild the temple, and Haggai's responsibility, his commission, was to encourage the people, to exhort them to resume the task of building the temple. So we get to chapter 1, verse 1 in Haggai. It picks up right where we were there in Ezra chapter 5. It says, "In the second year of Darius, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Eternal came by Haggai, the prophet, to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest." So we have specific dates, and there'll be four of them that we'll see, on which Haggai delivered messages to the governor, Zerubbabel, and the high priest, Joshua. And we'll see more about the two of them when we get into the book of Zechariah, which will hopefully begin at the next Bible study. So here's the message that Haggai delivered to them, and to the people through them. Verse 2, "Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, saying, this people says, the time has not come, the time that the Eternal's house should be built." The conclusion that the people of Judah had reached was, you know, times are just too difficult. It's not working out. Things aren't coming together. They're not falling in place. And so they decided that it was not time for them to build the temple. They decided that God was not opening the door or making it possible for them to do so. The date of this first message, the sixth month on the first day of the month, corresponds to our calendar date of August the 29th in the year 520. So it was in late summer when Haggai first began to speak to them. The circumstances were difficult. There were obstacles. There were uncooperative people in the land who were working against them, so they simply gave up. They apparently were waiting for God to make it easier for them. They apparently blamed God, in a sense, for not giving them the resources, the time, the help that they felt they needed to do their job. They failed to recognize that God had already intervened for them in so many ways and brought them back to their land, protected them as they built the altar, laid the foundation, and even built a wall around the city. They quit when they should have continued. They did not show the courage, the initiative, and the faith to continue the project. Pretty obvious lesson for us. We are about the business or the job of building the temple in a spiritual sense. If we wait for the ideal time to obey God, the ideal time to commit ourselves and to really work faithfully to obey Him, then that's a mistake on our part. But people sometimes tend to do that. They tend to say, well, you know, as soon as I get this worked out or this part of my life comes together, then I'll be able to be more devoted to or to overcome this certain area of my life. God is looking for us to faithfully obey Him also, even during times that are not ideal, times that are difficult. Verse 3, "The word of the Eternal came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and this temple to lie in ruins?" In other words, they were focused on building their properties, on rebuilding their lives, and they didn't take into consideration the importance of the temple in God's eyes. They left it in ruins while they focused on their own priorities. Verse 5, "Now therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways." In other words, think about it. Think about what you're doing. Think about what you've experienced. Verse 6, "You've sown much and bring in little." You eat, but do not have enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but you're not warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. In other words, they were spinning their wheels. They were putting all their effort into what their own priorities were, and it was not being productive. No matter how hard they worked, it just wasn't coming together for them. They couldn't get ahead. It was like having holes in their pockets. They'd put, you know, their wages in, and they would just fall out onto the ground. Again, we see a clear parallel and a lesson that we can apply ourselves. The way that we contribute to the household of God in our time is by our spiritual development, by our support for the work the church is doing. Jesus Christ warned us in Luke 21 not to be distracted by the cares of this life, not to be drawn away from what our real priorities ought to be, as happened to the people of Judah. So he says again in verse 7, think about it. Consider your ways. And then he tells them what they ought to do. And this is the theme, or the purpose of Haggai's messages. Verse 8 of chapter 1. Go to the mountains and bring wood and build the temple, that I may take pleasure in it and be glorified, says the Eternal. He tells them, regardless of how you may be in need right now because you've tried to take care of yourselves and it hasn't worked out well, he said, put me first, that I may be glorified. Stop neglecting the building of the temple. Verse 9, you looked for much, but indeed it came to little. And when you brought it home, it blew away. Why, says God? Because my house that is in ruins, while every one of you runs to his own house. The real reason that they were at this point not prospering wasn't because they needed to work harder, wasn't because putting forth effort in their own lives. It was because they were ignoring the work that God had given them to do. That's why, verse 10, the heavens above you withhold the dew and the earth withholds its fruit. I called for a drought on the land and the mountains, on the grain and the new wine and the oil, on whatever the ground brings forth, on men and livestock, and all labor, all the labor of your hands. Again, the people were not blessed because they were not putting God first. And it's a very obvious and, in one sense, a simple lesson for us as well. You know, Psalm 127, verse 1, is a really familiar verse. We'll just look at it real quickly. Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, the workers toil in vain. Unless we look to God, our efforts will fall short. No matter how hard we work, we work in vain unless we have God's blessing on our efforts. And God had withheld his blessing from them because they had not honored him. In Matthew 6, beginning in verse 25, Jesus talks about our priorities, that we should not seek physical treasure, but spiritual treasure. And we can't serve physical wealth and God. We have to put God first. That's the lesson that we see that the people of Israel also needed to learn. Verse 12, then Zerubbabel and Joshua, along with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Eternal, their God, and of Haggai. So, remember, before they went into captivity, they ignored, they belittled, did not heed the warnings they were given. So maybe they learned something while they were in Babylon. Because when they heard Haggai give them this message that they needed to change their approach and to put God first, they listened. And the leadership listened. Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the high priest, they responded to the message that they had received. The people, it says, feared the presence of the Lord. So they had enough They realized that, and they were convicted of their errors, and they changed their approach. Verse 13, then Haggai, the Lord's messenger, spoke to the Lord's message to the people, saying, I am with you, says the Eternal. So God promised then to turn things around and to bless them because they had been willing to change their heart and their approach. And God stirred up their spirit, it says in verse 14, and they all worked on the house of the Eternal of Hosts, their God. So they made that change in their approach. And again, it teaches us that God blesses our efforts as well. When we repent, when we dedicate ourselves to serving God, God is pleased with that. And he recognizes that we are working on it. Now, it doesn't say they had finished it here, but because they had begun to work on the house, God extended his blessing to them. And as we work in our lives towards spiritual growth and development, as we work in support of the efforts of the church to preach the gospel, then God blesses and smiles upon us, so to speak, and blesses our efforts as well. This occurred on the 24th day of the sixth month. That's what's kind of a turning point for them. Within 3 weeks, you compare that to chapter 1, verse 1, within 3 weeks, the people changed their approach and they began to dedicate themselves to building the house. Now, in chapter 2, verse 1, we find the second of the four messages that Haggai delivered to them. This was on the seventh month, in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month. This was, the first message was one of really chastising them for not having focused on the building of the temple. This message, the second message, is one of encouragement that God will bless them in their efforts because they had begun to work on the house. On the temple. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people, saying, who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory, and how do you see it now in comparison with it? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? Remember when they first started this project, some 18 or so years earlier, many of them were already discouraged at that point that the temple that they were building would not be nearly as impressive and as special a building as the one that they were replacing. And so they're asking, you know, who among you can remember back to that first temple? One thing to notice here is that this was on the 21st day of the seventh month, which is the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. So as they were observing the Feast of Tabernacles, this message came to them. And many of them, I'm sure, also remembered that it was during the Feast of Tabernacles that Solomon had dedicated the temple that he built. And so the celebration of the feast reminded them of Solomon's temple. And then they're asked, well, you know, how many of you or how many among you can remember having seen that first temple? We saw already that those who remembered Solomon's temple were a bit discouraged by what was happening here because this was not as glorious of a building. Verse 4 continues, yet now be strong, Zerubbabel, and be strong, Joshua, and be strong, all you people, and work, for I am with you. So the exhortation they received was, okay, it's not going to be the same quality of a building, but be strong. Do the job you were told to do. Be strong is stated twice. Be strong, Joshua, be strong, you people, and work, for I am with you, says the Eternal. So it's an exhortation to to not be so worried about what happened in the past and to go forward. He assures them that he has not abandoned them. I am with you. Much the same can be said of God's church. Over the years, we're all very familiar with the fact that God's church has decreased in size a great deal. We're not nearly the size that we once were. And often in conversation, many people will mention that, wow, we used to have three congregations in the area, Pittsburgh AM, Pittsburgh PM, and one out in Beaver. And we had hundreds. We'd fill up this huge auditorium when we had the Holy Days at Soldiers and Sailors. And you think back on those times. I have similar memories of the congregations we were part of out on the West Coast. Wheeling is coming up next month on its 50th anniversary. At one point, there were over 600 people meeting in Wheeling. And they had AM and PM services. And many of you remember that. And again, remember what it was like here in Pittsburgh. Well, God has put Jesus Christ at the head of his church. And Jesus Christ is in charge of what happens in his church. And we have, I was told just a few minutes ago, we have 39 people here for a service in Pittsburgh this afternoon. We could hang our heads and shake our heads and just be amazed at how tiny we are now. Or, as Haggai told God's people, as God told his people through Haggai, be strong and go forward. The Lord of hosts, he says, I am with you. I have not left you. Remember what we saw in Matthew 28? Let's go back there just for a second. Matthew chapter 28. Jesus Christ gave this job to his disciples, to his church to do. And he says in verse 20, teach them to observe all things I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. The age is not yet ended. Jesus Christ is still with his church. We wonder sometimes, why is it going this direction? When will there be growth once again? When will things turn around? Will it be during this age or only after Christ returns? We don't know. It's not our job. Our job is to do what Christ said, to take that gospel message through every door that's open and make disciples as he calls them and to do the work that Jesus started. How he does that is up to him. Our job is to be strong and work. And that's what we have the privilege and the opportunity to do as part of God's church. And if there's a tiny congregation now compared to what used to be a very large one, that's something that Jesus Christ is responsible for, and he will lead those who follow him. Verse 5, according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you, do not fear. And we think back not just to what it was like in 1974 in Pittsburgh, but we think back to God's hand leading his people, and God's still leading his people. Verse 6, for thus says the Eternal of Hosts, once more, in a little while, I will shake heaven and earth, the sea and dry land. I will shake all the nations, and they shall come to the desire of all nations, and I will fill this temple with glory, says the Eternal of Hosts. This is a prophecy that really has not been completely fulfilled. We know that shaking heaven and earth and the sea and the dry land and all the nations is something that will occur as part of the day of the Lord, as the time before Jesus Christ returns to his temple. And the desire of all nations, he says, that will come. And that in the New King, the words desire and all and the nations are capitalized, and pointing out that the translators understand that that's a reference to Jesus Christ. That Jesus Christ is going to return. He's going to shake the nations. He's going to shake the earth. And he's going to fill this temple with glory. That's what the people in Judah needed to hear. It was that God was going to bless that temple and bless that work and fill it with glory. And not to worry about the past, but to go forward. Verse 8, the silver is mine and the gold is mine, says the Lord of hosts. You know, Solomon's temple was fabulous. You can read of the incredible wealth that was put into it, that David began to store up and that Solomon finished, and then the building of the temple. Where'd all that silver and gold come from? It was from God. God is the one who allowed that temple to be in the form it was, and God is the one who provided for the people of Haggai's time the resources they had to build that temple. And so it's really kind of almost dishonoring God to worry, to fret, to stew about a lack of resources. God has all the resources that exist, and he will decide how much to provide for his people at any given time. Again, that applies to the church today as well. We must be worthy stewards of what God has given to us. And then God will be pleased with the efforts that we are making. And if he wants to grant us more physical wealth or more members or more resources, then he will. Our job is to work and to be strong, as we saw earlier, carry on with what God has provided us. Verse 9, again, another promise. The glory of this latter temple shall be greater than the former, says the Eternal of Hosts. And in this place I will give peace. The latter temple probably is a reference to another temple which will be built during the millennium. Ezekiel writes of and describes a temple that will be built during the millennium. That temple is going to be where Jesus Christ will reign from when he rules over the earth. And it will be much greater and much more glorious than any other, than either of the previous two temples or of the tabernacle. And in this place I will give peace. Again, another hint at looking ahead to the millennium. So that message was one of the second message here, that from verses 1 through 9 in chapter 2 speak of the promises that God is making to his people as they gather and refocus their attention on building the temple. Now, before we continue here, we want to just take a minute to go back and consider a message we find in the book of Zechariah. Turn back to Zechariah chapter 1, or ahead to Zechariah chapter 1, verse 1. And notice that it says, in the 8th month of the 2nd year of Darius. Now remember that Haggai's second message was given in the 7th month. This is another message, and Zechariah is mentioned in context of Haggai a few times here. This message of Zechariah falls between Haggai's second and third messages. And it also is directed to the people as they return to their work on the temple. So as an aside, let's look at what Zechariah wrote to the people in this same time frame. It was after, is between Haggai's second and third messages. So verse 2 in Zechariah 1 says, the Eternal has been very angry with your fathers. Therefore to them, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, return to me, says the Eternal, and I will return to you. Do not be like your fathers, to whom the former prophets preached, saying, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, turn now from your evil ways and your evil deeds, but they did not hear me. Zechariah says, don't repeat the mistakes that got us into captivity in the first place. Verse 5, your fathers, where are they and the prophets? Do they live forever? Yet surely my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not overtake your fathers? So they returned and said, just as the Eternal of Hosts determined to do to us, according to our ways. In other words, it's talking of their repentance. So Zechariah, in this same time frame, delivers another message to the people, reminding them not to turn their back on what God has told them to do or warned them about, but that they should heed, listen to the warning messages they've received, and not make the same mistakes that were made before. So we find that it's of some interest that that message came to the people again during the time that Haggai was delivering his messages. Now back to Haggai chapter 2. We find that the third and fourth messages were both given on the same day. Verse 10 begins the third message that Haggai delivered. He delivered it on the 24th day of the ninth month. So now it's been almost 4 months since the first message was delivered. And it's been 2 months since the second message was given. And a little more than 1 month after Zechariah gave his message. So it all came in a relatively short period of time. The people had already begun to rededicate themselves to the temple, to the building of it. And now they've received a further encouragement in the second message of Haggai, a reminder in the message that Zechariah gave. And here now the third message also reminds them, and we could summarize this message with the phrase that we find in Leviticus and also in 1 Peter. We could summarize the intent of this message, or the content of this message: be holy, for I am holy. A reminder to the people of to live in a way that represents God. Here's the message, verse 11. Thus says the Lord of hosts, now ask the priests concerning the law. So here's kind of a riddle that the people were told to ask of the priests. If one carries holy meat in the fold of his garment, and with the edge he touches bread or stew or wine or olive or any other food, does that food become holy? Well, the answer it says is no. If there's food that's been set aside and blessed and sanctified for an offering, and it touches some other food that is itself not blessed, does that food become holy because it came into contact with the holy food? The answer is no. So then Haggai said this, another riddle. Ask another riddle. If one who is unclean because of a dead body touches any of these, will it become unclean? The answer to that is yes. If it's unclean, then touches something, then that also becomes ceremonially unclean. So then Haggai gives the lesson that he wants them to learn from those two riddles. Verse 14, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, and so is every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean. In other words, because of the sins of the nation, Judah was becoming unclean. They were at risk of being back in the same position they were in before they were taken into captivity. The building of a new temple all by itself would not make them a holy nation. The building of the temple was important, but that would not make them a holy nation. Verse 15, now carefully consider from this day forward, from before stone was laid upon stone in the temple of the Eternal. God is taking them back to what had already happened. This goes back to before they began to rebuild the temple. Since those days when one came, So I thought about how their efforts fell short, again in verse 16. They expected 20 ephahs, there were 10. They expected 50 baths of oil, and there were 20. So again, their efforts had not been blessed. He says, I struck you with blight and mildew and hail and all the labor of your hands, and yet you did not turn to me. So this was going back to before the time that they had repented. So now, keep that in mind. Remember that lesson he's telling them. Consider now, from this day forward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from that day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. In other words, again, he's reminding them, don't turn away from the work that you understand now that you're supposed to be doing. And verse 19 speaks of what they anticipate in terms of a harvest. And again, they're looking for it because they are seeking God's blessing. So it's a reminder to them that what will make them holy is not just building a temple, not just building a building, but it is because of the way that they will dedicate themselves to God. There's a kind of a hidden prophetic meaning here as well. It would take quite some time to really fully develop it, but I'll just mention it. Without going into a lot of detail. God mentions here in this verse that he says, carefully consider from this day forward. The day that he's telling them to note is the 24th day of the ninth month. That corresponds on our calendar to December the 9th. This was 4 months or so after Haggai had begun speaking to them. It was on December the 9th in 1917, that very day, that the Turks surrendered Palestine to Britain. And the British monarchy then began to establish the nation or the homeland of Judah. It was a turning point that came about in Judah's history that was way in advance of, or much later, back clear up in 1917. So it was on that very day that the nation or the homeland of Judah began to be reestablished. So there is some significance to that very day that God told them to note, and something very special happened on it in the year 1917. Let's go ahead then and finish out the chapter. Verse 20 says, again, the word of the Lord came to Haggai on the 24th day of the month. So it's on the same day, apparently later on that day. And this short, brief message, which concludes Haggai's prophecies, is a prophecy of the return of Jesus Christ. Speak to Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, saying, I will shake heaven and earth. Again, same thing that he'd said in chapter 1, verse 6. He says, I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the Gentile kingdoms. I will overthrow the chariots and those who ride in them. The horses and their riders shall come down, everyone by the sword of his brother. So this overthrowing and destruction of the Gentile kingdoms is something that Jesus Christ will accomplish at his return. In Daniel 2, it speaks of the stone that was not cut by human hands, dashing the feet of and crumbling the idol, or the image, in Daniel 2. And it indicates the beginning of the rule of Jesus Christ. So this is a prophetic statement about the time, what Jesus will accomplish when he returns. In that day, says the Eternal of Hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, and I will make you a signet ring, for I have chosen you, says the Eternal of Hosts. Zerubbabel was, first of all, an ancestor of Jesus Christ. If you look at the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, you see in verse 12 that Zerubbabel was of the lineage that led to Jesus Christ. So he is used here as a type or as a symbol of Jesus Christ, a symbol of the authority that Christ would have when he returns. A signet or a stamp is a ring that was used to officially engrave a document to show that it had come from a king. So it represents the authority that Jesus Christ will have when he returns. So the prophecy here, or the book of Haggai, ends very abruptly with this short prophecy about Jesus Christ and his return, given again in the context of the promises made to the people of Judah, because they were now returning to the work of the temple. And it also in some way represents again how Jesus Christ will be returning to that temple, to his church at the end of the age. You see some comparison or analogy between the temple that they were building and the spiritual temple that the church is today. So it's a very short book, one of the shortest, again, in the Bible, but packed with some interesting history and some interesting prophecies as well, and a great deal of very strong message to the people of God's church today, that we also be busy about, as Jesus put it, be busy about our Father's business and doing the work that God has given us the privilege to be part of in our personal life, as well as in the work that the church is doing in preaching that gospel message. At the information table, there is a copy of the Life, Hope, and Truth article. I did send that out by email to those who are on my list. You can pick up a copy of that if you did not receive a copy of it in the email that's at the information table. So that will conclude then our discussion today on the book of Haggai.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Well, brethren.